in fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.
Here come the drums.
CRIMEWAV. You're rolling with the Crime Wave, the internet's first and only podcast devoted to the crime short story. I'm Seth Harwood, your host, the first name in crime podcast fiction, and I'm ready to bring you this week's story. The Crime Wave is produced by Mystery Dog, Aldo Calcagno, and it is not safe for your minivans. That means it might contain swearing, violence, and all types of shit.
Consider yourselves warned.
Welcome to Scott Sigler's Bloodcast. This podcast contains harsh language, adult situations, and lots of violence. So get off the babysitter, crank up the volume, and if you're easily offended, I would turn it off now, pussy! Here we go. Episode number one of Kissy Man and the Gentleman. Enjoy. I wanted to punch Brad Levin in his perfect face, for no other reason really than it was perfect. That face had never eaten mud while bullets splashed dirty water and blood all over it. That face had never known the kind of hunger that makes you eat a three-day dead rat. That face had no knife scars, no shrapnel wounds, no pockmarks, not even a damn zit. But punching him would be rude and bad for business. You don't punch people who politely offer you a job. And no one called him Brad Levin. Not anyone in the business, anyway. We all called him what he was. We called him the Gentleman.
"So what do you say, Kissy Man?" the gentleman said in that smooth baritone, the kind that belonged on a shaving cream commercial. "Does this sound like a business opportunity that appeals to you?"
I took a sip of coffee, then huddled deeper in my overcoat. The diner wasn't much warmer than the frigid weather outside. I looked at the headlines on the newspaper neatly folded up on the table to the gentleman's right. Truman defeated Dewey? I'd heard there was an election coming, but business had been brisk, and I hadn't had time to pay attention to politics. The gentleman waited, patiently, politely. I never liked him. Never. I liked his money, though. Liked it just fine. I looked around the diner, taking in the American stereotypes that lined the counter, sat at the tables. America had won the war, and that success gave everyone a bit of self-congratulating attitude that still seemed to permeate years later, from the postman at the counter to the three construction workers in the far stall inhaling eggs and toast. I didn't like New York City all that much, but at least it was better than Berlin. My eyes drifted back to the pretty boy, to the gentleman. I was an officer in the SS, okay? I'm blonde, big in the shoulders, with a jaw like a pit bull. I killed Jews. I killed Americans. I killed the English. I killed the Greeks, the French, the Italians, the Polish, and a bunch of Russians. I am the Aryan race. And yet this farm boy from Kansas makes me look about as Aryan as Blind Willie. Blind Willie is black, you see, so therefore he doesn't really look very Aryan at all.
"I certainly don't want to sound pushy," the gentleman said. "I do respect your right to think the offer over, but I'm afraid I'm on a bit of a tight schedule, so I'll need an answer from you now if you want to do business. If not, I understand completely, but I really must move forward."
Maybe it's his good looks that chafe me so. Features like his belong in Hollywood, starring opposite Ronald Coleman or Joan Crawford. A movie star face like that is why he gets all the rich ladies as clients. The fact that he has that heavyweight contender's body doesn't hurt either. He actually was a contender at one point, but it turned out his 15 wins were against hand-picked opponents. His 16th fight? He faced Jersey Joe Walcott. Nothing hand-picked about that one. A few body blows from Jersey Joe, and the gentleman didn't come out of his corner for the second round. Retired from the ring after that fight. Maybe he knew that if Jersey Joe landed one of those shots on his nose, the gentleman's good looks would be gone forever. So he got out of boxing for good. Some people would call that weak. I call it smart. Very smart. A face like his was a meal ticket in any industry, and in the private detective game, it was a gold-plated license to turn your shisha into $100 bills. I didn't have a face like that. Women of culture and breeding, it seemed, didn't like my scars for anything other than a night of danger, and only then, if nobody knew. The waitress came to refill our coffees. I wondered if she knew I was German, if she was looking down her victorious nose at me. She walked away. I poured sugar into my coffee. No more evasiveness. The gentleman deserved an answer.
All right, I said. Why me?
He smiled. I wanted to kick his teeth in when he did. But I wouldn't do that. Just because he handpicked those 15 fights didn't mean he wasn't a good boxer. And those muscles under that tailored suit told me the gentleman's jab could knock me silly. If I ever went up against this boy, it would be with a knife or a gun. Bare knuckles were the tool of the stupid. I picked you because you're a Nazi, the gentleman said quietly. Soldiers like you are known far and wide for your resourcefulness.
Resourcefulness. That was one way to put it. Leave it to this guy to put a nice spin on the fact that once I took a job, I'd do whatever had to be done to deliver.
He had also just politely told me that he knew my full background, and that was bad. My history wasn't a total secret, mind you. Quite a few people in the city knew. But some people knowing was a far cry from every GI in the city coming after me to avenge a friend they lost in Normandy or the Ardennes. I'd done everything I could to escape and hide my past. Yet looking at this man who looked more master race than I ever had actually made me jealous.
What if I don't take the job?
The gentleman shrugged. I'm sure you have your reasons, and I'm sure they are rather valid. But if you don't take the job, I gotta go to Harlem and find someone who will. I'd rather use you, as at times the Negroes can't move about as freely as a white man. They are so burdened by the inequities of our society, and I'd love to give them a chance at the business, but my clients' needs come first, of course.
His clients' needs. Was he banging her? Was he banging Beth Copenhaver?
Probably. Things like that happen for guys like the gentleman. Things like that did not happen for Kissy Man.
Who is trying to get her?
I asked. It was the same thing as saying, I'll take the job, and he knew it. Of course he knew it. Like I said, he was smart. So smart he was the only guy I knew who worked the bodyguard racket like he did. Some bodyguards actually protected their clients, were willing, even proud, to put their bodies in the line of fire. The gentleman, maybe he would take a bullet, but so far no one knew because his strategy was far more effective. He hired a hitman to take out the person threatening said client.
Smart. Real smart. And I was the hitman being offered the contract.
The misguided soul's name is Mathis Wren, gentleman said. He's been sending Miss Copenhaver threatening letters for some time.
He pulled an envelope out of his breast pocket and slid it across the table.
Here's a few of the letters. Not all of them, but you'll get the idea.
Does he have a history with Miss Copenhaver?
Does it matter? I'm hiring you to take care of the situation at hand. How the situation at hand came to be this way, if you'll pardon my brusqueness, is somewhat irrelevant. I made a mental note to look up brusqueness. That was another reason the boy bothered me. He spoke with the long-winded apologetic tones of the English, but in that buttery, smooth American accent.
And the police, I said. Why do they not do something about this?
The gentleman shrugged.
They have talked to Mr. Wren, even exceeded their authority a few times, so to speak. But Mr. Wren is rather obsessed with Miss Copenhaver. She thinks he's going to do something rash eventually, and I agree. The only way I can truly protect my client is to make sure that Mr. Wren can't hurt anyone. And that's when I figured it out. That was why I hated this man, the one they called the gentleman. It wasn't his face, it wasn't his body, it wasn't his baritone voice. It wasn't the fact that beautiful movie stars like Gladys Copenhaver sought him out, paid him exorbitant fees, and probably sucked on his cock to boot. It was the fact that he didn't do his own dirty work. He sighed and checked his watch.
I'm afraid it's time for me to head over to Harlem. My motto? Do whatever it takes to make the client happy, Kissy Man.
He stood.
I'll take the job.
I laughed a little. It's just what I do sometimes, and I'm not really sure why.
That is fantastic news, the gentleman said. I'm sure you'll come through for my client. You understand, of course, that no one knows you work for me.
I nodded. Guys like the gentleman walked about in the bright lights of downtown with women that looked like Beth Copenhaver. Guys like me? Well, guys like me stayed in the shadows. Guys like me pulled the trigger. The gentleman reached into his very expensive suit and pulled out a second envelope. He set it on the table. There's one large in here, plus some additional information on Mr. Wren. When Mr. Wren, how shall I put this, ceases to be a nuisance to Miss Copenhaver, there's another four large for you. A total of $5,000. Incredible. And that was just my piece of the pie. Made me wonder just how big Beth Copenhaver's pie really was. The word pie made me think of pussy, and for some reason I wondered if her pussy smelled like apples. I'm sure the gentleman knew the answer, and considering his blessed life, I'm sure the answer was yes. The letter read, "Your future is decided. You know where you belong, Beth. You know we're unhappy. I watch you on the screen, and I know you are really looking at me. I hear the lines you say and know you are talking to me, secret words in your words that only I understand. You are calling for me to come get you, Beth, to pay your bill. Forever is yours. Forever is ours. Death will not stop us. Ever." Not exactly the poetic words of Heinrich Heine. It was strange to read letter after letter from an obsessed man who couldn't really spell. W-E-I-R instead of W-E-apostrophe-R-E, H-E-R-E instead of H-E-A-R. The spelling errors alone told me that his education was little more than the sixth grade, or that he was intentionally putting those errors in, trying to make people think he was stupid. I couldn't talk to the police, find out what they knew, what they had tried. I had a contact on the force, Detective John Viscara. Big John, they called him. He was Italian, first generation. He rarely bathed, and even when he did, he still smelled like sour milk. I could have got the inside info from him, but if I asked about Mathis Wren, and then a few days later Mathis Wren turned up dead, that would cause problems. Money will make the cops look the other way for almost anything, but not murder. Well, they will look the other way for that, for money, just not the kind of money that I had at my disposal. The only way to handle a situation like this was to go take care of it head on. Now, believe it or not, I don't like to kill people. I had my fill of it during the war. I have to put food on the table, though, and I'm not that skilled at anything else. Still, I'd rather not kill someone if I can avoid it. What I could do was paint the proper picture for Mr. Wren, let him understand that he had only two options, and he really wouldn't enjoy the second one. I needed backup. Blind Willie wasn't right for this job. Wren's address was out in New Jersey, in a section thick with the Irish. The Irish and the Negroes got along about as well as the Germans and the Jews, except that both the Irish and the Negroes liked to fight at the tiniest provocation, be it real or imagined. Taking Blind Willie to the Irish sector meant I wouldn't get three blocks before some redheaded lad was calling Willie a nigger, and I probably wouldn't make it four blocks before Willie started calling some redheaded lad's mix, and by the fifth block, Willie would start shooting. No, this kind of thing required subtlety. Subtlety of skin color, but not subtlety of size. That's what had me walking up the dimly lit stairwell of a dirty apartment building, coat collar flipped high, hat pulled down tight, eyes on the ground. Every other door I passed either had a baby crying somewhere behind it or a dirty kid standing in it, staring at me as I passed. That was the thing with the Irish. They bred like rabbits. He lived on the fifth floor. I walked up there as quickly as I could without running. The Irish aren't fond of ex-Nazis, you see. Not that anyone is, mind you, but tens of thousands of Irish boys had gone to Europe to fight for the States, and many of them were still there, buried in Normandy, the Ardennes, and around Berlin. Europe had cast out the Irish for a new home in America, and America had sent their sons right back a few generations later. I reached his paint-peeled door and knocked. After a few seconds, I heard floorboards creaking. I'm surprised the whole damn building didn't shake when he walked. The door opened, and there stood Sean Lefty Ryan. He was just under 6 feet tall, a bit shorter than me, but where I weighed a good 210 pounds, Lefty had to weigh almost 300, and none of it was fat. Solid like a fucking mountain he was, every part of him thick and almost freakishly distended. If he'd had a right arm to match the muscle coil monstrosity that was his left, he would have easily weighed 325. Most men who had lost a limb in battle wore clothes that covered it, made it look as neat as possible. Sleeves rolled up and pinned, pant legs tailored to avoid empty swinging fabric. Most men, but not Lefty. He wore a white cotton sleeveless shirt, what the Americans called a tank top. The shirt's shoulder straps exposed both his gigantic left arm and the gnarled, scarred stump that ended where he'd once had a right bicep. Lefty's eyes narrowed, but he kept still. He could kill me with that left arm, and he knew it. But he also knew I didn't make a habit of letting people like him close enough to make that happen. You see, Lefty had watched me work. He'd heard me laugh.
"You better be here to pay me, you freak," he said. "I can holler for help and 20 Irish boys will tear you to shreds, and that's if I don't get you first."
I smiled and slowly held open my trench coat. Normally, I carried a Luger in the right shoulder holster. This time, I also had one on the left.
"I have plenty of ammo for all your friends, Lefty, but I don't think I'll have to use it because I brought your money. May I come in?"
Lefty stared at me, doubt in his eyes. He knew that once I entered the apartment, if I wanted him dead, I could do it faster than he could react. But he also knew that if I'd wanted him dead, he probably wouldn't have seen me in the first place. He left the door open and walked back into the dingy, one-room apartment. Floorboards groaned complaint with each of his steps. I entered and shut the door behind me. An efficiency. A king bed, because he probably couldn't even roll over in a queen. A kitchenette with a hot plate. A sink full of dirty dishes, with more dishes stacked on the small counter. Food crusted so hard, it might as well have been part of the porcelain. The garbage can was overflowing with Budweiser bottles and empty, white cardboard Chinese takeout boxes. That was all Lefty had, save for one big, thread-worn chair and a reading lamp that stood behind it. And books. Stacks of them, everywhere. Piles dominated by names like Sandair, Joyce, Moore, and O'Brien. Not a Rule or Werfel in the bunch. The books were beat up. Probably already well-worn before Lefty bought or stole them. All except the ones from the library. Those were in a single, tidy stack. Only one other thing in the apartment looked tidy. A single shelf with two small, framed pictures. The frame on the left showed an angelic-faced girl, perhaps 5, her eyes glowing with intelligence, her skin a light caramel brown. The frame on the right showed a boy, perhaps 6, his lips and a sneering smile of mischief. His eyes were the same shape as the girl's, although his skin was far blacker. A candle, half-melted, flickered in the space between the pictures. Lefty sat on the bed, which creaked in a complaint similar to that of the floorboards. Sweat stained his stretched tank top. He wore big combat boots to cover his big feet, and his pants had been patched so many times Kissy Man wasn't sure of their original color. Lefty's big hand gestured to the chair. The chair's cushion was permanently warped into the shape of Lefty's huge posterior. When I sat, I sank in and felt like a child sitting in Papa's chair. "The money?" Lefty said. He was still afraid. That's why I liked him, because he was smart. I reached into my outer coat pocket. I knew better than to keep it in an inside pocket. This close to Lefty, reaching inside my coat, where my guns were, might spark a sudden and unfortunate reaction. I pulled out an envelope and tossed it to him. He caught it with the ease of an athlete, then pinched it between his knees as his left hand flipped through, counting. He looked up at me.
"You only owe me 150, Kissy Man. There's 200 in here."
"Consider it a late fee."
He shook his head.
"No. No, I don't want to be indebted to you for anything."
I shrugged.
"Then give it away to some of those filthy children out in the hallway. I'm not taking it back."
The word children did the trick, as I knew it would. Lefty looked at the envelope, then placed it under his sweat-stained pillow.
"So you paid me," he said. "Now leave."
"I have another job for you,"
I said, but he was already shaking his head no before I finished the sentence.
"Lefty, just hear me out."
"No," he said. "No way. I don't want to work for you ever again. You ain't right."
"What is the problem? You did fine last time."
His face screwed into an angry mask and he leaned forward. I stared back, ready to go for my Luger if I had to, but not wanting to draw on this mountain of a man. I needed him. Lefty leaned, but came no further.
"I ain't that guy anymore," he said. "I thought I left that guy in Europe, but you... I just don't want to be him anymore.
I don't care what version of you is where, Lefty. I need backup for a simple job. I just want to talk to someone. Convince them to leave a lady alone.
He shook his head. Listen, Kissy Man, I appreciate you paying what you owed and then some, but I can't do this stuff anymore. I gotta get a job, make money for...
His voice trailed off. He wanted to say, for his kids, of course, but those words were hard for him.
I know you need some money, Lefty. That is why I am here.
It's not just the money, you Nazi piece of shit. I gotta be there for them.
I sat still as tears welled up in his eyes. Be there for them. Such an interesting choice of words for a man that lived alone.
Lefty, I assure you, this is an easy job. All you have to do is sit in the car for 5 minutes. You know Beth Copenhaver?
He wiped away a tear.
You mean the movie star?
I nodded.
Yeah, I seen two of her films. That one with John Wayne was really good.
Well, the man I have to talk to is threatening her. I have been hired to make him stop threatening her. I want to talk to him. I go in, you sit in the car for 5 minutes. I come out, we leave, you get paid. If I don't come out in 5 minutes, you come in.
And do what?
Well, hopefully you just stand there. You have a certain presence with other men. I'm sure you know this.
He nodded.
So you come in, I said. Hopefully a couple of handsome fellows like ourselves will convince this man to leave Miss Copenhaver alone.
And what if he doesn't agree?
I shrugged.
Then you go back to the car and I come out a little bit later.
Lefty looked away, then rubbed his eyes.
Right. You'll kill the guy.
Lefty, predicting the future is not in my powers.
And what if I come in after my 5 minutes and you're not having a nice conversation? What if I come in like last time and there's more men and guns and knives and all kinds of shit? What then?
If it is like last time, Lefty, you do what you did last time.
He stood and shook his head.
No, that ain't worth $150, Kissy Man. You said your piece, so please get the fuck out of...
$500,
I said. That stopped him cold, mouth still open, words frozen in mid-sentence. He closed his mouth and licked his lips. His eyes flickered to the two picture frames, then back to me.
500?
I nodded.
100 up front right now. The other 4, when it is finished.
His left hand rubbed his left thigh.
And it's just one guy.
As far as I know, yes.
He stared for another second. Then his chin dropped to his chest and his eyes squeezed tight.
Okay. When?
Now, of course.
He raised his head, nodded. He'd known the answer to that before he even asked the question.
Can we take a drive out to Harlem first?
I should have known that was coming. Lefty now had $300 in hand, a fortune for him. If he didn't make it out of this simple assignment, he wanted to ensure the money got where it needed to go.
You'll have to make it quick, I said.
He nodded.
It won't take long. It never does.
Lefty walked the 4 steps to the kitchenette. He knelt and opened the cupboard below the sink. He reached in and pulled out one of those knives the American soldiers used and slipped it into his left boot. Then he pulled his patched pants leg down over the top of the boot. He reached in deeper and pulled out a .38 special, handle covered in dirty tape. With practiced, one-handed ease, he opened the chamber and checked that it was loaded. The gun went into his left pants pocket. He reached in one more time and pulled out the thing that he was famous for in these parts, a blackjack. The curved, rounded piece of metal looked like a toy in his thick hand, but Kissy Man had seen it in action, and it was no toy. Lefty stood and walked to the door. He lifted a long black coat from the hook and slid it on, then put a wide fedora on his thick, Irish head.
Let's go, Mr. Kissy Man.
I stood and walked out the door. He followed, just 2 creaking steps behind. Now that Lefty had taken the job, everything would be Mr. This and Mr. That. Sean Lefty Ryan was nothing if not a proper employee.
So that, my criminals, is how we roll out Crime Wave episode 53. Now, why do we love Sigler? Let me count the ways. Scott Sigler is not only a gangster, godfather of podcasting, but he's the one who taught me the trade. That's right. He's the one who showed me how to use iTunes to convert MP3s, how to edit shit in GarageBand, all of this. And Jack Wakes Up never would have been a podcast without his ass paving the way. So this motherfucker, that's right, we owe him a little bit. Plus, he's going to do some great promo for us for the Young Junius release in trade when it comes out on May 5th. But we give him the love. So if you want to get your ass a copy of The Starter pre-ordered and then delivered to you in September, basically it's the same schedule as we're looking at for Young Junius. You're going to pre-order that in the spring, right around now in May, and then you'll get the book in October or so. Scott's looking at April pre-orders. Book is going to get to you in September. It'll be signed. It'll be personalized, numbered. Basically, when you buy it, you get to say in PayPal how you want him to sign it. So I say something like, Scott, I want you to sign this by saying, Dear Seth, you're the best writer I know. I never would have been able to do any of this without you. So if you decide to buy a copy, first of all, use the code Seth, S-E-T-H, to get a discount. And then when you tell him to sign it, just have him sign it. Dear fan of the Crime Wave, Seth Harwood is the best writer that I know. God damn, I wish I could write like him. I can't even podcast like him. Seth is just the best overall around. It's such a pleasure for me to be able to teach author bootcamp with him. You know, etc., etc. I'll let you fill in the rest. Scott is my partner for Author Bootcamp. We've got another session coming up at Stanford the end of this month. It'll be on Saturday, April 24th, and Saturday, May 1st. Those two Saturdays. It's going to be a lot of fun. If you're in the Bay Area, come out. The Stanford course goes for a mere $250. And believe me, two full days of us yapping, it's a bargain and a half. Imagine it. The beauty of us yapping. It's great. Bring your laptop. We get to surf the web together, look at our videos, all kinds of good stuff. It is kick-ass. So you come over to the site, you will get links to Scott's episodes for the rest of the Kissy Man. He just posted episode 8 today. I think that might be the last one. I have listened to more of this novella, and it kind of kicks ass. When they end up going after this dude, he's got some crazy cult shit going on with robes, big-ass fires. It's kind of spooky. So check it out. Also, you know that Scott's books are out, Infected, Contagious, The Rookie, The Starter, Ancestor coming out soon, and I give it up to my boy Scott. His website is scottsigler.com. You go to scottsigler.com/thestarter to get your copy of the new novel. Word 'em up, what else we got? Over at my site, like I said, I got a hot tub cast this week about what's going on with Young Junius. I got some new art coming from Bob Ostrom, plus art for the cover of the book from Jerry Scullion. I'm about to hit you with a promo for J.P. O'Donnell's Deadly Codes podcast. That book is out. You can get it at Amazon.com. You can get the book to listen to on Podiobooks.com for free. If you haven't checked out Podiobooks.com, you owe it to yourself to do it. All kinds of free stuff there. Next week here at the Crime Wave, we're going to roll into a short story by Debbie Mack. Actually, it's the first chapter of her novel, which you can get at Amazon. Then we're following up with Gerald So and his posse for the lineup, Poems on Crime. Love it. If you want to hear last year's episode like that, it was Crime Wave 36. Now they're back with another issue of the lineup. You got to dig that. Those boys throw it down criminal style in the poetry. I love it. What else we got? I'm going to hit you with some promos for Scott and for J.P. O'Donnell. I'm going to hit you with a short promo for Young Junius and then fly at you with the first 12 minutes of The Starter, the podcast. I'll break it down to you like this. The Starter, Scott says, is Any Given Sunday meets The Godfather meets Star Wars. It is some crazy intergalactic universal shit that involves football, mafia dons, and let me see. More football. Yeah. So they got a human. He's like the quarterback for this team. He plays with all kinds of crazy aliens who are wide receivers and shit. Basically, they take the aliens and based on their body type, they fit them into these football positions. It all makes sense. It comes out in the wash. If you like ESPN, football, and crazy science fiction, you ought to check out this podcast of The Starter and The Rookie. Listen to The Rookie. That'll really give you a feeling for the love of it. So I got lots of love for Ben Leroy and Allison Janssen. I'll probably hit you again with Ben's promo before we roll out to get your books for the spring rollout of Tyrus Books. New fiction. Hello Kitty Must Die. They got a Victor Gishler book coming out. They got some dynamite stuff. I hope you dig the background music here with me. It gets me shaking my head a little bit. Shake your head with it. I hope you love it. I hope I'll see you soon with more crime. Stay criminal.
Aliens and humans alike wanted to stop him at any cost, kill him if possible, destroy his quest for glory. He marshaled his forces and unified all the races under his violent leadership. They fought as one, left their blood on the field of battle, but persevered and conquered. He led his comrades to victory time and time again. And now, he's back for his second season. Quarterback Quentin Barnes returns for his sophomore effort with the INF Krakens in Scott Sigler's hardcover novel, The Starter. On sale April 1st, 2010 at scottsigler.com/thestarter and at amazon.com. The sequel to The Rookie, The Starter is a sci-fi sports gangland mashup described as Any Given Sunday meets The Godfather meets Star Wars. This signed, numbered, limited edition collector's item is available for pre-order on April 1st, 2010 at scottsigler.com/thestarter and at amazon.com.
Deadly Codes, a Gallagher novel, the award-winning sequel to Fatal Gamble, written and narrated by J.P. O'Donnell, winner of Editor's Choice and Reader's Choice in 2009. Follow the thrills as Boston Private Eye Daniel Cormac Gallagher Jr. investigates the death of Jennifer Clark, tragically killed in a car bombing in her own driveway. Jennifer's husband, Bill, holds a top-secret position in counterintelligence for the National Security Agency. Was the bomb intended for Bill as part of a terrorist act? And what was the role of Jennifer's secret lesbian lover, who vanished immediately after the car bombing? Gallagher discovers that the car bombing is only a backdrop to a complex treasonous scheme to sell code-breaking formulas to a hostile enemy nation. As the violent mystery unravels, Gallagher finds himself under deadly attack from two shocking but powerful forces, one he knows and one he never expects. For more information about the author and his books, visit www.jpodonnell.com.
Hey, this is Ben Leroy, and if you want to support the people who are bringing Mr. Harwood's Young Junius to the marketplace this fall, then take some time to head over to tyrusbooks.com right now, where our entire spring 2010 is available for pre-order. And when you find that little bit of gold in your shopping cart, why don't you go ahead and throw in super secret promo code Cinco de Harwood and watch your bill get smaller. And if you aren't cool with shopping online, then get into your local independent bookstore, place those orders, let them know we sent you. Thanks, and have a good time reading.
What's up, listeners? This is your boy, Young Junius, the special edition. Presale begins May 5th at SethHarwood.com/Junius for a limited time only. This will be a collector's item you definitely want to pick up. So I'll see you May 5th at SethHarwood.com. Stay criminal.
I'm getting in the groove now, so I'm like giving it my own shit now. All right.
Bring that beat back, man. Bring that beat back. Bring that beat back, man. Bring that beat back. Bring that beat back, man. Y'all want to hear that beat, right? One, two, one, two.
Time for sports headlines. All Galaxy quality content taken from the pages of the INS City Gazette.
And here is the latest from Toyat the Inquisitive. Dateline, New York City. Earth, Planetary Union. GFL officials today announced the schedule for the 26-83 season. Following their successful year-end first-place finish in the Tier 2 tournament, the Ionath Krakens earned promotion to Tier 1. Ionath was placed in the Planet Division, replacing the demoted Free Birds, who finished the 26-82 Tier 1 season with a record of 1-11. The Planet Division has 11 teams. The Krakens play each team once, and also have two cross-divisional games with teams from the Solar Division, plus one bye week, which makes for a 12-game, 13-week schedule. In week one, they visit the Isis Ice Storm of the Tower Republic, who finished last year with a record of 7-5. In week two, the Krakens come home to host the Themela Dreadnoughts of the Quith Concordia, who finished last year with a record of 5-7. Week three, home again, against the 3-9 Shora Chieftains in a cross-divisional game. Shora Chieftains, of course, are from the Hurrah Tribal Accord. Week four, it's off to the Key Empire to face the Toe Pirates, who finished last year at 10-2. Then, a home game against the Wabash Wolfpack, formerly known as the Wabash Wall, of the Tower Republic. Last year, Wabash finished with an impressive 9-3 record. Week six is a bye week, followed up with a big road trip. First to the Lou Juggernauts of the Key Empire, 8-4, then to the Alamum Armada of the Sklorno Dynasty, 4-8, and finishing up the road trip with the Coronandolana Cloud Killers of the Hurrah Tribal Accord, who last year finished up with a lowly 3-9. In week 10, the Krakens host the Yal Criminals of the Sklorno Dynasty, who last year finished at 11-1. Then another home game against the Hitoni Hullwalkers from the League of Planets, who were an even 6-6. The second-to-last game of the season is another cross-divisional outing against the Jupiter Jacks of the Planetary Union, who finished last year at 10-2. And the final game, the Krakens come home to face the Mars Planets, also from the Planetary Union, who finished last year at 4-8. The question on everyone's mind, are the Krakens demotion bound? The Krakens' primary objective this season is to win more games than at least one other Planet Division team. The team in the Planet Division with the most losses is demoted down to Tier 2, to be replaced by one of the teams that reaches the championship game of the Tier 2 tournament. For reference, keep in mind that the Freebirds won the Tier 2 tournament in 26-81 to earn promotion, then proceeded to lose 11 games in the 26-82 Tier 1 season and went right back down again. In the past 10 Tier 1 seasons, six of the teams that won promotion were demoted the following season. So what is the magic number of victories to stay in Tier 1? Well, the Freebirds were by far the worst team in Tier 1. With them demoted, most analysts agree the teams in danger of demotion are the Coronandolana Cloud Killers, the Mars Planets, and your Ionath Krakens. Ionath likely has to win at least three games to avoid demotion. Ionath faces almost certain defeat against the Planet Division's dominant franchises, including the Toe Pirates, the Wabash Wolfpack, and the Yal Criminals. The Krakens' two cross-divisional games are a split. The good news? One of those games is against the perennial Solar Division demotion contender, the Shora Chieftains. The bad news? The other cross-divisional game is against the 26-82 GFL champion Jupiter Jacks. But what about a Cinderella run for the playoffs? While the odds of the Krakens making the T1 playoffs are just a bit lower than every star in the galaxy simultaneously going supernova, this column wouldn't be complete without providing playoff math. It's simple. The four Planet Division teams with the best records go to the single elimination tournament. In the case of equal records, the tiebreaker is head-to-head results. Last year, in 26-82, the four Planet Division playoff qualifiers finished with records of 11-1, 10-2, 9-3, and 8-4, respectively. As we just mentioned, before the Krakens land 8 wins this season, every sentient in the galaxy would die in the burning gases of their suns expanding at nearly the speed of light. Scientific translation, it's not going to happen. This has been Sports Headlines, taken straight from the pages of the Ionath City Gazette, brought to you by Junkie Gin. Junkie Gin tastes like a touchdown every time. They came home at night. They came home champions. Quentin stayed in his room aboard the Touchback. He was just too nervous about the return trip. Wouldn't it be ironic to fight through the war that was his rookie season, win the Tier 2 tournament and reach Tier 1, then fly back from Earth only to have the team bus crash on the way home?
That thought made him more nervous than normal. Since he started every intergalactic trip assuming he was going to crash anyway, it made for a tense flight. He waited. He waited for the sickening feeling of the punch-out, of the ship slipping back into normal space. The ship started to vibrate, shake a little. "It's fine, it's fine, it's fine, just relax." He repeated the mantra in his head, but it didn't help. This was it. He'd die on this stupid ship before he even played a down of Tier 1. "It's fine, it's fine, it's fine." His eyes were already shut tight. He squeezed them even harder until his upper lip curled. The reality wave started cascading over the ship. Just because he couldn't see it didn't mean he couldn't feel it. His stomach churned, an oily, queasy feeling that threatened to coax the dinner out of his belly. That feeling of splitting, spreading, being in several places at once. It pulled at his mind, told the part repeating, "It's fine," that that part was full of crap, that things were most certainly not fine. And then, it was over. Quentin opened just his left eye, just a little, making sure that everything in his room looked solid, that it was not shimmering and waving. It was not. He let his breath out in a long rush, then ran to his bathroom and threw up.
Thank you for listening to The Crime Wave. I'm your host, Seth Harwood. I hope you'll check out the rest of the stories here on Crime Wave and tell your friends about it. It's the CRIMEWAV. Help pass the word, register at our site so that you can participate in the forums and add comments to the episodes. You can email us with questions or comments at info@crimewave.com. Aldo, the mystery dog, and I will get your email and we'll get back to you right quick. You can also call the K7 line, 206-350-4998, to leave comments or feedback. And if you leave a great message, we'll even play it at the end of a show. So drop a line, hop on the website, visit often, spread the word, and thank you for stopping by The Crime Wave.
In fact, it's a crime. It's a crime.